May we turn to the last book in the Bible, and chapter 13. Revelation 13, and starting to read at verse 1. And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, but his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. Verse 5, and there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. Verse 15, and he, that is the second beast, had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak, and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their forehead. And that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Then in chapter 17, don't ask me presently what 666 means, because I don't know. Chapter 17, and starting at verse 11. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goeth into perdition. And the ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. May God bless the reading of his word. A few years ago, I sat having a late lunch one day in a well-known club in Brussels. A friend of mine with whom I had been talking that morning had taken me out to lunch with him. We'd argued for hours and finally reached agreement and signed a particular document on behalf of our two countries. While we were having lunch, he started talking about the attitude of Britain and said quite bluntly, I don't think that Britain will ever find a place in the European community unless she changes her attitude completely. They're rather blunt words, because in another part of the city, discussions were going on that particular point. Well, we parted good friends. And I took the train down to Le Tourneux on the border of Belgium and France. There my son had come up from France to meet me. And we went into a restaurant to have some tea. As we sat there talking, presently we looked at a television screen on the wall. And a moment or two later, there flashed on the screen a tall man with a curious shaped nose. And around him, a company of reporters. And the one word that I remember more distinctly than any other is the word no. And that man was expressing precisely the same point of view as was my Belgian friend only a few hours previously. But why all the fuss and bother? Why all the concern in that particular day and again during the present month about what those folk were talking about? In other words, why all the fuss and bother about what is commonly called the common market? What is that, this subject really? In 1957, six countries came together and signed a couple of treaties at the city of Rome. As a result of one of those treaties, there came into being the European Atomic Energy Community and also, on the other side, the European Economic Community. 6 years earlier, another treaty had been signed that brought into being the European Coal and Steel Community. The six nations concerned were Holland and Belgium, Luxembourg, France and Western Germany, and Italy. Six nations that today form one community and are rapidly in process of becoming one complete entity. By the end of the present calendar year, in all probability, those three communities will have become a one. At the moment, each is governed by a commission, and at the head of the commission is a president. But by the end of 1967, probably, there will be one commission and one president. Why bother about a collection of nations like that? Well, pause for a moment or two and realize the size of the community concerned. First of all, there are 170 million people in that collection of nations. Secondly, the exports from those nations or from that community total twice the exports of the United States and 10 times theirs of Soviet Russia. The imports are tremendously large, too. You know, probably, the purpose of the community. So far as the European Economic Community is concerned, the primary purpose is to bring into one a collection of nations. You'll be told, of course, that the primary purpose is to create a common market. That is not the primary end. It is only one of several purposes. The primary purpose is to bring into one entity a certain number of nations. And by the end of 1969, those six powers and any others that may have joined them will have become, at least industrially and economically, one complete block. And if French proposals are carried through, by the end of 1969, they will also have become politically one block. Realize the implications. In other words, national sovereignty will have been surrendered to a supranational power, and full control of those six nations will be in the hands of a commission and finally of one man. Industrially and economically, it does seem highly desirable. For between those six nations, all tariff barriers are being destroyed. By the end of 1969 again, there will be no customs barrier between anyone of those six. But on the other hand, there will be one common barrier against all other nations. And not one of those six will have the power to negotiate preferential treaties with any other country. There will be six countries acting from a tariff point of view completely as one. Highly desirable from more points of view than one. For in the hands of the governing body, there is power to streamline, to rationalize, to eliminate duplication, and to overhaul the whole machinery of industry and commerce. May I use a very simple and rather silly illustration? Suppose, for example, it were decided by the governing body and realized that it is not merely the commission, but ultimately, virtually, one man, if it were decided that all textile manufacturing should be carried on in one particular country, the factories in all others would have to be closed down and workers transferred to the particular country in which that manufacturing was to be carried on. So that one plain implication is mobility of labor, and consequently, mobility of capital as well. For obviously, finance must follow where labor goes. But in the hands of a small body, so far as the commissioner is concerned, nine civil servants, and finally in the hands of one man, the president of the commission, despite the assembly of 142, finally in the hands of one man, will be the control over all industry, commerce, and economy. In all probability, control also politically. Now pause for a moment. In 1961, France tabled proposals, as provided for under the Treaty of Rome, for political integration. The proposals were discussed at Bad Godesberg and rejected. Revised proposals were tabled at Paris in 1962 and are still awaiting discussion. It is only a question of time before those or similar proposals are actually accepted and implemented, so that one can visualize in Europe a collection of nations acting as one completely integrated whole, a solid block, with one foreign policy and with one home policy, economically acting as an entity, a tremendous threat to commerce and industry in every other part of the world, and a threat, if I may put it quite bluntly, to your own country as well. Other countries are applying for membership of the community. Britain and Southern Ireland recently applied. Greece is at the present moment an associate member. Spain is talking about the possibility of applying. There are six members at present. There is a possibility of another four becoming part and parcel of that community in the not too distant future. But there are six, and six that in a few years' time, a couple of years probably, will be one solid block. Now take another glance at the picture. 77% of the population of those six countries is nominally Roman Catholic. I say nominally because, for example, in France, Roman Catholicism means nothing more than a name. But here, prima facie, there is a solid block of 170 million people, three quarters of whom are Roman Catholic. And another fact is perfectly clear, too, that those countries are going to be controlled by some form of dictatorship. For if one places in the hands of one man complete control over industry, over commerce, over politics, then quite patently one is placing dictatorial power in the hands of that one man. Well, you may say it sounds pretty good. Certainly advantageous to those countries concerned. Highly desirable from many aspects. Why then should we be concerned with what is going on in Europe? And why should we bother as to what countries enter the community and what the future holds for them? Well, when one comes back to the Bible, one discovers a picture that is not entirely dissimilar from that which is being painted in Europe today. May I say one thing? Don't go away presently and say that I declare that the European Economic Community was identical with what the Bible paints. I've said nothing of the kind. What I do say is that what is occurring in Europe does bear a resemblance, and a marked resemblance, to what the Bible paints. And it is not impossible that what we are seeing today may be the precursor, or if you like to put it in a different way, the embryo of what the Bible predicts. Well, what does it predict? It talks in Daniel's prophecy and in the book of Revelation as the coming together of powers. In Daniel's prophecy, it's put in a rather curious way. To Daniel it was revealed as to King Nebuchadnezzar that four great world empires were to cross the stage, and after they had run their course, God himself would establish an empire that should never be removed. Those four great empires, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, have actually run their course. They appeared upon the stage and then disappear. But so far, God has not established that fifth empire. If one examines the picture more closely, this fact emerges from the picture. That fourth empire, quite apparently, was divided into two parts. And in the two parts were 10 kingdoms. The Empire of Rome certainly was divided into East and West. You cannot trace anything comparable with what Daniel describes in past history. So that one is left with a conclusion that if that last stage has not actually been seen in history, something has occurred. Either there is a tremendous gap, and a gap of centuries now, or else God is not going to fulfill his word. But when one comes over to the pages of the New Testament, again one discovers that in the latter days there will be found a collection of nations, 10 in all, acting as one integrated whole, and giving their power into the hands of one man, so that that one individual acts as the supreme dictator through those 10 countries. So complete is his power that he will be able to control industry, labor, and capital. Look at the picture painted in Revelation. We're told, for example, that no one may buy or sell without a permit from that power. Virtually also that no one may secure employment but by permit. A mark in the hand or a mark in the forehead. It doesn't imply, of course, that someone is going round with a branding iron, branding someone in the hand and others in the forehead. What is being portrayed symbolically is this fact, that every manual worker will have to belong to his trade union, that every professional worker will have to belong to his professional organization, and the control of those bodies will be in the hands of a central authority. Fantastic, you say. What is occurring in Europe today is quite patently along the same lines and might quite well be the forerunner of what is described in Revelation 13. There is to be a man in supreme power over industry, over workers, over all employees, and over employers as well. In Europe, by 1969, it will be impossible to establish a factory, but by permit from the central authority. It will be impossible to start a new line of manufacturing, but by permit from the central authority. And quite obviously, from what is said, not only in the treaties, but also in the discussions that have gone on, it will be impossible for workers or employees to choose where they're going to be employed. Everything will be under the control of the central authority. May I add this also? This is no passing phase. This is not something transient. Under Article 240 of the Rome Treaty, these conditions are binding indefinitely. In other words, not one of the six signatories to the treaty can detach itself from the others. Those nations are bound together and bound permanently. And any other signatory to the treaty accepts by virtue of his signing the same conditions, and in particular, the same article. Never again will that country stand on its own feet. It will be bound permanently to the collection of nations, to the European community. What Revelation is painting is probably not quite so remote as appears at first sight. What is being described again is a collection of nations roughly in the same area as the old Roman Empire. It was Rome that had finished partially its course and left part unfulfilled. So that quite obviously there's a future history for that great power. You may prefer not to describe it as the Roman Empire or a revived Roman Empire. What is being described is a great power on the lines of the old Roman Empire and possibly in roughly the same geographical area. It is, of course, not imperative that the same countries, the same area, should come within its scope. But there is a picture, and there is no dubiety as to its significance. 10 powers, 6 today, have come together. Others are attempting to join. So that again I say, what is described may not be quite so remote as at first sight might appear. Go on one stage farther. You recall what we said the other night, that power, that political beast, the collection of 10 nations, will be controlled for a long while by a religious power. And we saw quite clearly from Revelation 17 that that religious system was something far greater than Roman Catholicism, but that it had its headquarters at the city of Rome. 77% of the population of those six countries is nominally Roman Catholic. So that once again, these things are not so fantastic as they might first appear. A control or domination by a political power, but only for a period. For the political power turns upon that religious power and destroys her. Now turn back to Revelation 11, and you'll discover another interesting feature. During, for 3.5 years, during what some prophetic students say is a period synonymous with the 70th week of Daniel 9, there stand up two witnesses in Israel, two who are faithful to God and bear witness to Him. After 3.5 years, I'm interpreting the symbol, they're martyred. And presently their bodies caught up to heaven. After 3.5 years, it's a logical assumption also that the period of the domination of that ecclesiastical power over the political is again for 3.5 years. A curious indication that at roughly the same point, the faithful witnesses to God and the false church are destroyed. Well, you may say that might be interesting, but of what significance can it be? Go back to Daniel chapter 9 and read the closing verse, and you'll discover this, that there is a treaty between the Western power, unquestionably these same nations, and the Jewish people, a treaty that is to last for 7 years. Halfway through that period, something occurs. All religious worship is stopped. And we're not told clearly what happens next. If, however, you look at the margin of the Bible, you'll find a reference to idols. Idols of the desolator upon the battlements of the temple. Now go over to 2 Thessalonians 2. You get wearied by my references, just go to sleep, and I'll wake you up in a moment or two. But in 2 Thessalonians 2, the Apostle Paul tells us that in a coming day, and if you read the earlier verses, you'll come to the conclusion that it is after the removal of the church, a man will enter the temple of God and proclaim himself to be God and seek divine homage on the people who gather around that temple. Now go on to Revelation 13, from which we read. And here we find that the second beast referred to in the chapter, a man who rises out of the land, in other words, one who is a Jew, and almost undoubtedly the future ruler in Israel, will make an image of the Western ruler and set it up in the temple and claim divine homage for that image. You can't believe it, can you? In this 20th century, a resurrection of the old Caesar worship is quite impossible. Extremely unlikely to put the slightest gloss upon it. Quite impossible, you say. Pause for a moment and cast your mind back over the last few decades. It's not so long ago that words were addressed to Joseph Stalin that were blasphemous. Prior to that, words were addressed to Benito Mussolini that were appropriate only to God. To Adolf Hitler, the same adulatory terms were addressed. More recently, to the deposed ruler of Ghana, a man who knew the Christian faith and was brought up in a Christian mission school, the same kind of expression was addressed, so that it is not entirely removed from men's minds. And it does seem possible that there might be an adjustment of thinking to an acceptance once more of the idea, the concept of the old Caesar worship. But add to it this fact, that to that lifeless image, the Jewish ruler will have the power to impart life and enable it to speak. I can't accept that, you say. That must be a symbolism. Well, wait a moment. Go to Edinburgh University today and ask to see PET, a parametric artificial talking device. And if you're taken into that room, you may see a prototype of a talking machine. Address the question to that machine and turn certain knobs, and you may receive an answer in the voice of an old man. By adjusting the machine, an answer in the voice of a child. For into that machine have been built most of the sounds of human speech. It's crude. It's only a prototype. But mechanically, what is forecast in Revelation 13 is a possibility. But what God is talking about is not mechanical, but actual. This man will impart life to the image. Some years ago now, nearly 10 years ago, Professor Stanley of Berkeley University in California conducted certain experiments. And passing nuclear rays over inorganic chemicals, he produced microscopic viruses capable of feeding and reproducing themselves. 18 months after, the Russians, by a totally different kind of experiment, produced amino acids. And only a few months after, by passing rays through gaseous substances, produced the same kind of material, the foundation of blood and muscle and nerve. And not so long ago, the Russians produced, by a somewhat similar experiment, biostructures. You may dismiss that sort of thing and say that viruses and biostructures are certainly not life as we understand it. But pause and think. If you have read even the most popular papers, you will have realized this, that there are two countries striving might and may to be the first in the field to produce life as we understand it. What the Bible described 19 centuries ago may not be on the verge of fulfillment, but there is no doubt that men's minds are adjusted to this idea of the creation of life as we know it today. God meant just what he said. Don't come to me presently and say that the power of creation of life is reserved to God. The Bible does not say so. It does say in him was life. It never says that man will ever be able to create life. On the contrary, it does say quite clearly in this particular chapter that a man will impart breath or life to that image and enable it to speak. Now visualize what might occur. At that time, an inanimate object suddenly coming to life and speaking. Can you wonder at the crowd paying homage to that man and to that image? What the Bible forecasts may not be so entirely remote, I say again, as at first sight it might appear. Here is the reason for the acclamation and the acceptance of that man as God, just at the moment when he stops all religious observances, whether for good or for evil, whether the faithful witnesses to God or the false church, that man stands where his image is and demands and receives homage due to God. You can't see it occurring, can you? Nearly 10 years ago, I think it was, Monsieur Honoré Spaak, the Belgian, one of the outstanding statesmen in Europe, said this: Europe needs a man. We don't care if that man be God or devil. We'll give our power into the hands of that man. Realize that men's minds are adjusted to the idea of a God or devil. To that man we'll give our power. And when that man appears, there's no dubiety, homage will be paid. And those throughout that great empire and throughout Israel will bow in recognition of his deity. This can't possibly occur while you're here. These things relate to a period after the church has gone. And yet, quite patently, they do seem to be casting their shadows before. Well, is God going to tolerate that kind of thing? The very verses we read give the answer. Go back to Daniel's prophecy again. There are the 10 turns of an image that Nebuchadnezzar saw. There are 10 powers, in other words, existing at the last day. And complete destruction comes upon those 10 powers. A boulder cut out of the hillside by no human hand rose down the hillside to fall upon those 10 toes and to smash the whole of that image to powder, then rapidly to expand and to fill the whole earth. In other words, God is saying pictorially, a tremendous power finding its origin in no human source will fall upon the political powers of this world, smash their power, and then itself expand and take universal control, that everything shall be subject to that power or to the one whom it represents. But what is being painted is the coming into this world of God's own kingdom and the one who has the right to rule. Go over to Revelation 17. And it's put more clearly and more explicitly, 10 kings who make war on the land and destruction comes upon them. So if you gather all the prophecies together, now just referred only to 2, you'll discover this picture. In those last days, the great power of the West, that tenfold ten-kingdom confederation will make war upon the Lamb himself. When? How? Here's a treaty with the people of Israel. A treaty of the last 7 years. Halfway through, and for the remaining half, there's the worship of that great power, the dictator who controls those 10 kingdoms. At its conclusion, something occurs. That treaty has several purposes. One, quite obviously, was the protection of Israel, and the protection primarily against inroads from north and south. You don't need to stop to think hardly to realize that. Trouble comes, both from south and from north. intervention, consequently, by the Western power. And as the Western power surrounds the city, trodden down by powers from the north, they will find, as others have found, that Jerusalem is simply an intoxicating cup to make them drunk and reel to and fro. And at that precise moment, heaven itself will intervene. As those powers are gathered together, Christ, our Lord Jesus Christ, will come back to this earth. He departed just the other side of a hill. He'll come back to Mount Olivet. And Zechariah tells us the mountain will split in two at the touch of his feet. Symbolism? Of course not. The geologist will tell you that among the geological faults that run through the country, there's one that runs right through Mount Olivet. Zechariah certainly could never have known. If there were some mighty impact, if there were an earthquake, we're told the mountain was split in two. At the impact of the feet of the Son of God, the mountain will split. Just as Zechariah foretold, those centuries ago, and Christ will come with all the myriads of his redeemed behind him to deliver his people, to establish his kingdom, and to execute judgment upon a guilty world. That will be the end of that great empire, that great collection of 10 powers. They'll make war on the land, and as Revelation 17 indicates, destruction will come upon them. Well, you may sit back now and say, well, this may be entirely in the future and a terribly long time ahead. Just stop and think. Just stop and think. From a purely human point of view, it cannot long be postponed. In embryo, you have something uncommonly like what the Bible is talking about. It may not be a very long time before 6 become 10. By the end of 1969 or early 1970, those nations will be one complete entity, politically as well as economically. National sovereignty will have been surrendered to supranational power. 6 into 10. Over that period is not impossible. Take a glance at Israel and listen to the words of David Ben-Gurion, repeated on more than one occasion. Sooner or later, will they be forced into an alliance with the West. There's no protection, no help from any other quarter. You need only look at the map to realize the wisdom of the sage old man. An alliance with the West. The threat is there today. The arguments for the alliance are clear to anyone who stops to think. The threat is implicit in the attitude of Egypt and in the attitude of Russia. Pause for a moment again, and don't think I'm talking lightly. Russia is suffering today, financially, as a result of the last few months. In 1956, Britain and France became aware of the plan of Russia to land the planes in Egypt and take over Egypt, details of which the American government still seem to be ignorant. One of the most serious things of the past decade or so, Russia's attitude has not changed. Her viewpoint is precisely the same. I hope if the Lord tarries, we'll talk about that more tomorrow night. But realize the threat is patently there today. I suggested also that the ecclesiastical power is rising today. And the other night we saw quite plainly how quickly this one world church might come into being. 1980, says Michael Ramsey. Why not 1970, said one of his followers. It's not so far distant. And at any rate, by 1980, one can see the probability of that one world church being in existence. What the Bible talks about does seem to be on the verge of fulfillment. Don't misunderstand me. I am not saying that this is that. I do say, however, it's uncommonly like what the Bible talks about. And one might well be forgiven for assuming that the predictions of the Bible are almost on the verge of fulfillment. One could take detail after detail, and they all force one to this conclusion. These things seem practically to be here. They may occur in the very near, in the foreseeable future. They can't, while you're on earth. These events relate to that period in which God is counting time. He does not count time in relation to a heavenly people. He doesn't count time in relation to the church. But if these things are close, the inescapable conclusion is that the end of the church era is almost here. That very shortly, those who belong to Christ will be swept away. That even today, our Lord might come. I'm just talking plainly. It's too late. It's too late to occupy ourselves with things that don't matter. Our Lord's coming may be so close that all your plans and proposals may never come to fruition. His coming may be so close that what you have in view for your own life may be impossible of achievement. His coming may be so close that what you have purposed, even for the near future, may not be possible. He might come just as soon as this very day. These things are indications of the imminence of our departure, of the imminence of Christ's return. Can you sit and ignore them? Can you just sweep them aside and say, we've heard things like this before, and still Christ has not come? Never in the whole course of human history has there been such a combination of indications as of the present day. On every side, all the events foretold in prophecy seem to be casting their shadows before. If they are, as seems unquestionably the case, then the return of Christ is practically here. May I put it again? Are you ready? Are you ready? Just suppose.